From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tite. On Tuesday's show, can you teach a new doctor how to have empathy for her patients, and does it matter what the doctor feels? Later, the story of a Milwaukee man's rise to the top of the rock music industry.
You know, the story of rock and roll is the story of great rock and roll managers. Artists need that guy who's just relentlessly, ruthlessly committed to their act, and Jeff clearly was that.
And renowned writer Amy Tan discovers accidental inspiration in a history book.
And I turned the page and I saw 10 beauties of Shanghai, these 10 young women, five of them wearing an outfit identical to the outfit my grandmother is wearing in my favorite photo of her that I looked at every day as I wrote for inspiration.
Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tite. Thank you so much for being with us today. When you're not feeling well and you go to the doctor, what are you hoping for from your visit? You probably want to get well, of course. But does it matter whether your doctor seems to really care about your well-being? Actually, there are reports that show it does. At the University of Wisconsin, a 2011 study of patients who turned out to have the common cold showed that patients who gave their clinician perfect marks for empathy recovered faster and had less severe symptoms than those who didn't. But doctors are people, too. And even as symptoms and test results play a role in how they treat patients, so too do emotions. Dr. Danielle Ofri has taken a close look at emotions in medicine in her work at New York's Bellevue Hospital, her occasional contributions in the New York Times, and her latest book, What Doctors Feel. She was in Milwaukee recently to give the annual Medical Humanities Lecture at the Medical College of Wisconsin, and she stopped by the Lake Effect studio to shed more light on the subject. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
I was hoping we could start by talking a little about empathy, which you write a lot about. In fact, even if it's not the obvious topic of everything you write, I think you could probably find some subset of empathy in much of it. It makes sense that people become doctors because they want to help other people. But is that desire the same as having empathy for others?
I think they're related, but not necessarily the same thing. When we think about empathy, we think about, I think, the standard definition of can you be in someone else's shoes and look through their eyes? And in medicine specifically is can a physician or a nurse really feel how the patient is suffering? And really the origin of the words comes from sensing someone's suffering.
Well, and is it just the health issues themselves, or is there something about understanding the weight, if you will, of the medical system around them as a patient comes in the door?
Well, everyone's illness is unique, and partly because everyone's life is unique. And so how one person's pneumonia affects their life is completely different from another person's. If you imagine a healthy 36-year-old soccer player has pneumonia, out 2 days back playing soccer, an elderly widow living alone with pneumonia might send them to a nursing home, and so it completely changes their life, yet it's the same disease.
So do you think is empathy something that ought to be taught in medical school, or is it a question of recognizing it and having it reinforced?
It's an interesting concept. It's one of those things you would think is a little hard to teach. I think that we do a very good job of selecting the right medical students. I mean, honestly, in all my years of working with students, I can count on one hand the number of people who didn't really have what it takes to be a good and empathic doctor. However, when we finish training them at the other end, we know from a lot of research that their empathy is at the minimum sorely tested, if not really, you know, eroded. And so something about our training, I think, is affecting that. And so our efforts, not so much to teach empathy, but to preserve it and to model how important it remains in medical care today.
I wonder if there's something to the idea of students and young doctors being able to even simply recognize it as they're feeling it.
Well, partly, I mean, when you're thrown into the medical world, it's like being tossed into Mars without an instruction manual. It's very disorienting. The language is different. The way of dressing, the ethics, everything is different. And students who are keen observers, they watch how their superiors behave, how they walk, how they talk, how they address patients, how they address nurses, and all these things are picked up on. We often call this the hidden curriculum. So there's the explicit curriculum they learn about in the classroom, compassion, empathy, professionalism, and then there's what they see how medicine is actually practiced in the field, and it's often quite different.
Right. You write at length about your own personal experiences having worked in labs and gone through classroom settings, and then when you're actually confronted with patients that are far different than anything you would have read about in just a textbook, it's a different story altogether.
It's absolutely different story, and I think we're just not prepared, and students aren't so prepared. Patients don't read the book either, and they bring their life to their illness, and it's really, you know, it's up to us to figure that out. And so when I look at who were the role models, they're the ones who in their practice would demonstrate empathy, to take the time to listen, to genuinely care. And those were the doctors who were different than the ones who were brusque and short-tempered, and you kind of know it when you see it.
Well, right. One of the really interesting personal examples you relate is that some of the most important lessons you received about meeting patients on their own terms came from doctors that we might have thought of as old-fashioned. But you write they exhibited something called clinical curiosity. What is that term getting at?
You know, so most of my attendings were these starched white men in starched white coats and bow ties, and their white coats always buttoned all the way up. And our patients at a place like Bellevue, which is a public hospital, were largely immigrants, uninsured people, homeless people. And I always wondered, how will they ever connect? As we brought our attendings to the bedside, I couldn't imagine how this, you know, alcoholic, undocumented Honduran immigrant will relate to this, you know, gray-haired white guy in with a bow tie. Yet, these doctors were very patient. They very much wanted to know what was going on with the patient. And they asked many questions. They did thorough physical exams. They were interested. And that interest in itself was a form of empathy and respect. And the patients got it. And they worshiped these doctors. They really felt these doctors cared about them, and they did. And so they didn't need to share the same characteristics. And these doctors didn't need to have been in the Peace Corps or backpacked in Nepal, but they were just interested in their patients, and patients pick up on that.
I wonder if, you know, I think about I have two fairly young kids, and they see doctors at kind of the rate that most children see doctors. And I think of all the pediatricians they've been in touch with, and it feels like there's some built-in empathy that comes with being a pediatrician. And maybe it's not built in, but I wonder if there's something to the idea that pediatricians don't necessarily come into a patient interaction feeling like their patients have made poor personal choices.
Well, one of the lovely things about pediatrics, which I really appreciated more as a parent than I did as a medical student rotating in pediatrics, is that, you know, kids, by and large, you know, they call it like it is. There's not a lot of premeditation. There's not much lying. It is what it is. And there's something really beautiful about that. Though when they actually study empathy, and there are scales that measure empathy, students who score higher on these empathy scales tend to go into primary care fields like pediatrics, obstetrics, internal medicine, family medicine, because they enjoy being with people. That connection gives them a lot of pleasure.
Where does humor come in? There's a lot of humor that you write about that doctors would probably find familiar and that patients might be a little aghast to learn about. But is it possible to have both empathy but also possess this kind of gallows humor that goes along with it?
You know, humor is one of those strange beasts. I mean, it's everywhere in medicine. And we all think, oh, this is so inappropriate. Yet I once worked with an attending in the intensive care unit who was from Tennessee, was also Jewish, if you can imagine kind of that Brooklyn humor, dryness, and Tennessee drawl combined together, who was always making jokes, and often at the expense of the patients. And I once confronted him, and he said, you know, everyone is dying here. What can you do but laugh? And I got his point, although at times it was awkward. I think that for many of us, humor is a way to handle situations that are very difficult. And as an attending now, as a senior doctor, I try to be very careful when I hear my team joking when it's not appropriate, but to recognize that the humor is a signal for something big, something uncomfortable. We're in that. We need to see what that is.
You also write, though, that people almost universally in the medical field attempt to compartmentalize what they're going through, and that almost universally it doesn't work so well.
No, it doesn't at all. And I think we use that as a coping mechanism. And to some degree, we need to be able to have some separation. I mean, often when you're with the patient, isn't the time for your own emotions to come spilling in. But if you don't attend to those emotions at some point, they will come out. A wonderful study of oncologists looked at the impact of grief. I mean, oncologists, their patients die at a higher rate than most of us. And they did try to compartmentalize, and universally it was a failure, that they would speak about grief would you know, follow them like a shadow. It would creep into their home life, their work life. It affected how they saw the next patients, and that it was a very real part of their lives. And they had to kind of negotiate an armistice with their grief. They had to face it, find a spot for it, but they couldn't ignore it.
Right. I think there's at least one medical center that you write about that that requires young oncologists in particular to go through, I guess these are sort of stress management seminars.
Well, this is in Rochester where they have the oncology fellows meet weekly to talk about what's happened this week. And part of it is acknowledging all the patients who have died, saying their name, saying a word or two about them. And it's open to anyone, the secretaries, the you know, the X-ray guys, if they want to come. But it's required for the oncologist to recognize that, you know, this is a very emotional field and you must have at least a spot to say, I have to acknowledge that, boy, it was a really sad week or a horrible week or a frustrating week, and here are the people who I've lost.
You also point out, though, that it is difficult to definitively quantify how this dynamic affects outcomes, whether it cures more illness or manages more illness, say. At the end of the day, why do you think it matters?
Well, one of the things – and I come from a background of science. My PhD is in biochemistry, so I'm very much attuned to and respect hard numbers. But just because we can't quantify it doesn't mean it shouldn't be important. There are many things in life we can't quantify. At some point we say – this is important. I mean, listen, when you feel sick and you go Google your symptoms, you could probably come up with a correct diagnosis, but it's hard to imagine that you'd feel taken care of. And I think most of us, when we're sick, want to be taken care of by real nurses and actual doctors, not by a computer. And that difference between your medical cure and being taken care of, being healed, it's hard to quantify that, but we all know the difference. And we want to be taken care of when we're sick.
You're right, obviously, from the perspective of a doctor, but, you know, obviously you are a person that's also seen by doctors. And I wonder if most of us who are in the position of just being seen by doctors would be well served to have some thoughts about empathy in mind when they walk in the door of the exam room, not to necessarily empathize with the poor, overworked resident. But is there some role for the patient to play?
I think so. I think that when patients come in, they will get a quick intuitive sense if things are going well or things are not going well, even if they can't put their finger on why. And very often when things are not going well, it has to do with the doctor's emotional state, whether they're overworked, frustrated, whether they've been humiliated by their supervisors. And that directly affects patient care. And I think patients being attuned to that, they may not often have the position or power to change that, but they can be aware that something's going on and not to ignore that gut feeling. And if they feel strong enough, they can say, hey, doc, something's up. Or they can talk to a practice manager, or maybe it's time to switch doctors. But there's no reason to settle for a doctor who's an excellent technician but has poor communication or relating skills. There are enough doctors out there who possess both that we shouldn't have to settle for someone with a bedside manner that rivals a roll of surgical tape.
Well, at the same time, you recently wrote a column in the New York Times in which you consider really just how much it's appropriate to share with your patients, the fine line between empathy and getting in the way by oversharing.
Interestingly, you know, doctors often will share, oh, I had a colonoscopy too, so I know how it feels, or, you know, my father had that cancer. And I think we view it as a way to empathize and connect with our patients. But when these patients were studied, most of them found it actually rather intrusive. And I think finding the line of when you are helpful and when you're actually just expressing your, you know, your own needs and issues. And I think we have to really look at the patient, you know, needs first. And sometimes a little bit of sharing is helpful. But in general, if it hogs the spotlight, it becomes detrimental.
In the midst of all this, what do you get out of playing the cello?
You know, the cello kind of came in sort of randomly when my daughter was taking violin and the teacher suggested it would be helpful to see a parent practice. So I still – and last night I was practicing way before I went to bed. You know, one thing in medicine, once you've been in it for a couple of decades, your learning curve is there, but it you know, flattens a bit. Whereas being in music, I'm still the new student and I'm learning every day climbing the mountain, and that intellectual engagement, but also the aesthetic engagement. You know, there's not a lot in medicine about beauty. And I think beauty has a role in our lives for psychological health, for a place to filter your own emotions, for a way to bring joy. So I find it endlessly stimulating, and it makes me work hard in a way that just kind of keeps me going.
And do you think you're at the point that you're good enough that what comes out of your cello allows you to kind of feel that beauty and that joy?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily go that far. But I think the act of playing and striving, you know, so when you actually – and as soon as you get there, they move the finish line. So now you have a harder piece to play. And so you're always in the act of striving. And that in itself, I think, uses parts of your brain and your soul that make for a resilience that I think is helpful in patient care.
Danielle Ofri, thank you so much for spending some time with us.
It's a pleasure.
Dr. Danielle Ofri's latest book is called What Doctors Feel, How Emotions Affect the Practice of Medicine. She's an associate professor of medicine at New York University, practices at Bellevue Hospital in New York, and is an occasional contributor to the Well blog for the New York Times. She spoke with us while she was in Milwaukee to give the Medical Humanities Lecture at the Medical College of Wisconsin. We expect doctors to have empathy for their patients. But surgeon and Lake Effect essayist Bruce Campbell points out that empathy does have its limits.
In the 1970s, before I went to medical school, I worked as a nurse's aide. Early one morning, one of the surgeons dropped by the emergency room in a particularly good mood. The ER doctor asked him why he was so happy. "It was the first night all week I did not get a call at 2:30 in the morning from Mrs. Swanson," he replied. I pretended to work but kept on listening. "Really? Why does she call you at night?" the ER doctor asked. "Well, it seems that since she was discharged from the hospital, she hasn't slept. I suggested medication, relaxation, exercise, dietary change, anything I could think of, but she still just couldn't sleep. She was spending hours each night roaming through the house." "And?" "And so when she couldn't sleep, she'd call me at home at 2:30 in the morning and tell me how miserable she was. Every night the phone would ring and there she would be." "So, what would she say?" "Well, not much. Same thing every night. 'Doctor, I can't sleep, doctor. Can't you give me something? I feel so tired, doctor. When will I sleep?' I was running out of ideas." The ER doctor thought for a second. "Well, why didn't you just tell her to call you in the morning?" "I did tell her that, of course. It just didn't make any difference." They stood silently for a while. I had no idea what the surgeon was thinking, but I was certain the ER doctor was trying to come up with other treatment options. The absurdity of the situation percolated. They both pictured the bleary-eyed woman forlornly padding around in robe and slippers, repeatedly checking the clock and finally picking up the phone. Finally, the ER doctor spoke up. "But at least you slept through last night." "No, I didn't say that. What I said was I didn't get a call at 2:30 in the morning." The ER doctor was confused. "Well, what do you mean?" "I mean she did not call me." "What? I don't understand. You didn't?" "Of course I did. At 3 o'clock, my alarm went off. I picked up my phone and called her." "Were you sleeping, Mrs. Swanson?" "You were? Oh, that's wonderful. I'm so happy for you. I just wanted to make sure that you were doing okay. Uninterrupted sleep is just so refreshing, don't you think? Well, good night." She mumbled something in return. "I'm pretty confident that will be our last middle-of-the-night conversation." The ER doctor shook his head. The surgeon grinned and pushed the metal plate on the wall, and the ER doors slid apart. He was humming as he headed down the corridor toward the elevator that would take him to the operating room where he would start his day.
Lake Effect essayist Dr. Bruce Campbell is a head and neck cancer surgeon at Frederick Hospital and the Medical College of Wisconsin. He also writes about his experiences in his blog, Reflections in a Head Mirror. Rock and roll is not necessarily an easy life, but a Milwaukee native's rise to success in the music industry was on an especially rough road. We'll learn more when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Of Lake Effect Now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. You'd be hard-pressed to find too many stories of people at the top of the music business who have not faced struggles or hardship along the way. But even within that context, Jeff Castellas is an extraordinary case. The Milwaukee native grew up in extremely challenging conditions here. He's dealt with abuse, professional challenges, alcoholism, and the death of a child, even as he has risen to become president of Elektra Records. Milwaukee writer Tom Matthews chronicles the remarkable story of Jeff Castellas in the December issue of Milwaukee Magazine, and he's with us now to tell us more about it. Welcome back to the show.
Great to be back.
What made Jeff Castellas such a compelling character for you that you wanted to pursue this story in the first place?
Well, this story was brought to me by Christina Douglas, who was the previous editor of Milwaukee Magazine. I'd done several music-based articles for them, so she thought this would be a good fit for me. I knew nothing of Jeff. I didn't live here at the time of his sort of time on the music scene here. But I got a brief sketch of the arc of his life, which is fascinating. And once I got him on the phone and spent the past year interviewing him, it was a truly remarkable story with Milwaukee roots.
This is a guy who has had his share of lousy things inflicted on him, both as a young boy and in his adult life as well. Is his resilience really the story here?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, if you mapped his life on a graph, the peaks and valleys are incredibly dramatic. He came from a broken home on the South Side. He was born in 72, which was when the divorce rate, in this country just went insane. His family fell apart. His parents split up when he was about three. His father, I think remarkably, got custody of Jeff and his two brothers because at the time I don't think the system was very refined in terms of determining custody. The father got a girlfriend. They opened a sort of a working class bar on the South Side. And she had kids, and they were all thrown together in this house.
But you're right. It was not exactly the Brady Bunch.
No, it was not. There was at times as many as 10 kids between the two relationships. The father spent all this time either at the bar or I believe he had a pretty good drinking problem. So they were left pretty much in the care of this girlfriend. And from Jeff's telling of the story, there was a great deal of emotional and physical abuse going on in this house from the time he was four or five until he sort of made his escape in his teenage years, about 16 or 17.
Well, you're right that rock and roll was really kind of what got him through it. How did that play out?
Well, there were some older kids in the house, which is the way a lot of us sort of find our musical influences from older brothers and sisters. His space was this cold, windowless room in the basement, and he just descended deeply into rock and roll.
In kind of a productive way, though. He was like the kid that was reading the liner notes.
Yeah, remarkably, he was just on the very tail end of the vinyl years. So he had that experience of holding that album cover and reading, as I did, every word on there. But he found himself gravitating towards not so much the musicians as those who are in the orbit of the musicians, the manager, the producer, the label executive. He read some now classic books on rock bands. No One Here Gets Out Alive, which is about the Doors, was very influential. And at a very young age, he got this itch to thinking that there might be a future for him, not as an artist, but as someone who would work with artists.
Well, and it sounds like there were not a lot of really positive moments in terms of his parenting when he was young. But one of them might have been that he kind of got his people skills from his dad, which kind of let him get an entree into the music world, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really stunning part of his story is that as a very young kid, he would be made to work in this bar after school, but also before school, like at 5:30 in the morning. He and his brother and some of these other kids would go to this bar and clean the bathrooms and wash glasses and get this bar ready for opening. But also in watching his father and how he sort of, I think, bluntly ran the business of this bar, he learned how to deal with people in a way that served him very well as he proceeded with his career.
he had this longtime love for rock and roll. He started to get kind of some popularity in high school. He was elected student council president. What allowed him to actually make that leap into the music world?
Shortly after he got out of high school, he went to what was then Milwaukee Tech. He heard of there was an intern DJ program at WMSE. And he applied for that and got into that program, and they quickly saw how committed he was to music, and finally got an on-air shift from
wonderful time slot.
Yeah. Midnight on Sunday until 2:30. By this point, he was living with his mother and would make a bike ride once a week, loaded down with albums and CDs. And he loved it. He was in his early 20s, and sort of concurrent with the radio gig, he started writing about music for Downtown Edition, which was a weekly paper at the time, Milwaukee Magazine, and even some national publications covering both local bands but also national acts as they started coming through town. So suddenly he's face-to-face with Pearl Jam and Smashing Pumpkins and hit really the big time for a kid, really.
And it sounds like the pivotal moment for him was when he kind of gave a group a bad review and they wanted to meet with him.
At the time, one of the big bands in town was Wild Kingdom. He had reviewed them and took a couple shots at them for, I guess, not writing enough new material. So one of their key members sought him out, and Jeff thought he might be headed for a beatdown. But instead, they invited Jeff down to their rehearsal space and with the idea that perhaps he could manage them. Which at first he said, you know, I have no idea how to do this. But again, going back to all this reading he did and research he did, he realized this is that thing that he was sort of destined to do.
Well, and so what was the group that ended up being his big break in the industry?
Wild Kingdom broke up. Most members came back together as Citizen King about 94, 95. And Jeff describes it as not just a band and a career, but really a gang that he was welcomed into and sort of helped filling in some of those emotional holes he still had from his childhood. And for the next, you know, including his time with Wild Kingdom, he committed 8 years promoting these guys locally and then sort of the Midwest, and ultimately got them a major recording deal with Warner Brothers Records. You know, the story of rock and roll is the story of great rock and roll managers. Artists need that guy who's just relentlessly, ruthlessly committed to their act. And Jeff clearly was that.
But the story of rock and roll is also the story of rock and roll bands breaking up.
Yeah.
And that gig eventually ended. What was the set of circumstances that eventually put Castellas into the top position at Elektra?
Well, the first album, Mobile Estates, came out in, I think, 99. Did okay, not great. They had the one single that I think most people have heard, I've Seen Better Days, Then the Bottom Drops Out. They were getting ready for a second album, and through a set of really complicated interpersonal issues, the band just fell apart, which was devastating for everyone. By this point, Jeff had moved to Los Angeles. He had been spending a lot of time there on behalf of the band, and his friends and colleagues out there had sort of been suggesting he needs to get in a bigger pool if he really wants to reach all of his goals. So by this point, he was already in Los Angeles, and sort of the story of his life, he bounced back from this kind of crushing defeat. He worked as a manager for a while out there, and then with someone else started an independent record label called Danger Bird, which throughout the 2000s did, you know, very, very well at a time when the music industry was starting to unravel.
He ends up in management level jobs in the record industry, having founded this record label. It sounds like things are going pretty well for him.
Yeah, I mean, he's really sort of living the dream, and I would imagine thinking that having survived these dark years as a child, you know, that maybe life was good. He got married in the mid part of the decade. She had a son who he took on. But then in 2003, they had a son named Pablo. And Jeff is quite candid in saying that his goal was to give this child all the joy and light that he did not get in his childhood. And to hear tell, they had a good start at that. But in 2008, just shy of Pablo's fifth birthday, he was diagnosed with what's called Wilms tumor, which is a very rare form of cancer that attacks kids. And he and his wife Joanne spent the next year trying to keep their son alive, all of which was documented by Jeff in this blog that he kept called PABlog, in which with excruciating candor he charts this year of trying to keep Pablo alive.
And in the end, he was unable to, which, again, just, you know, life dishing him something that's horrible that was really out of his control. He has since kind of really turned it into, if not a positive, certainly a force for positive things.
It's pretty remarkable. He had, by the point Pablo got sick, Jeff had become a deeply committed endurance cyclist. And turned to that as kind of therapy over the course of that year. While Pablo was still alive, Jeff had announced he was going to bike his way across the country as a show of support for his son. But when Pablo died just a few days after his sixth birthday, Jeff still made the ride with a team of supporters in tribute to Pablo. And also over the course of that period and then the years after, Jeff and his wife, I think his wife taking the lead, they started this foundation called PABLove, which has gone on to raise millions of dollars for research into childhood cancer, but also supporting children and families dealing with cancer.
So at this point, Jeff is the head of Elektra Records, which is a major label at a time when there aren't many major labels left. Where is Elektra in the industry today?
It's a subsidiary within Warner Music Group. It's hard to say exactly what a major label is anymore. They have a small number of acts. Fits in the Tantrums, which Jeff managed with Danger Bird, came to Warner Brothers and has really sort of exploded. That's kind of their big name now. They CeeLo Green, Ed Sheeran, people like that. But Jeff was taken on at Elektra, I think, in like August of last year. And the past year has signed a couple acts, but mainly is just trying to figure out how you make it work in this digital age of music, which has changed so dramatically from when he was a kid studying these record albums.
Do you get the sense he still feels anything towards Milwaukee?
He comes back on occasion. There's a PABLove concert here once a year, which I know he tries to attend. There's another one coming up this January. Local acts get together and they raise money for the cause. His brother still lives here. So he's here. I know when he is here, he tends to sometimes he's out checking out bands and things like that. He admits that he hears from a lot of Milwaukee artists and managers who, just like him, suddenly he's on the other side of the table getting harassed by an overly aggressive rock and roll manager. And he recognizes that, to the extent that he can, he will listen. He'll hear what you got and try to be responsive. But I would imagine he's probably a very popular man when he's in town. So he may keep a low profile.
Well, Tom Matthews, thanks so much for sharing this story with us.
No problem. Good to be here.
Tom Matthews' profile of Milwaukee native and Elektra Records president Jeff Castellas is in the current issue of Milwaukee Magazine. You'll find a link to it, plus more information about the upcoming concert for the Pavlov Foundation, which Castellas founded, from WUWM.com/Lake Effect. The song we're hearing, by the way, is the 1999 hit Better Days and the Bottom Drops Out by the Milwaukee band that Castellas managed, Citizen King. Another rip in the glass, another chip in my tooth. One last break, and then a glimpse inside early 20th century Shanghai life with writer Amy Tan. That's when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Mitch Teich. The issue of human trafficking is a significant one in 2013 between human rights abuses in places such as Sudan and global prostitution and internet pornography rings. A sting operation earlier this year saved 10 victims of human trafficking right here in Wisconsin. Writer Amy Tan's latest novel plays out in a different place and in an earlier era, one in which the sex industry was somewhat more out in the open, if not any less insidious. The Valley of Amazement plays out mainly in China early in the 20th century. It tells the story of one family's roles in the courtesan world. It examines mother-daughter relationships, betrayal and loss, and has a helping of dark humor as well. Amy Tan joined us in the studio recently to share her first novel in just about a decade. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Good to be here.
I was hoping you could start by explaining the significance of courtesans in Shanghai in the period in which most of this book is set.
The courtesans of Shanghai started around in the 1850s when this Shanghai was getting started. They are different levels. If you look at the continuum of the sex trade, there were first-class courtesans, second-class, maybe flower opium houses, women who took in people in their own homes, and then also streetwalkers, and then down to the sex slaves who were in the sheds. So it was about one out of every 100 women in Shanghai at one period were in the sex trade. Courtesans, one of the key differences also is that they were courted. They had many suitors who came, and the woman got to choose who would have their favors in the boudoir.
And in the case of a so-called first-class courtesan house, this was a fairly elite clientele.
They would be the top officials, the business people who would come, people who were doing foreign trade, which is a huge thing that was going on in Shanghai during that early 20th century. And I imagine they were privy to the secrets that people were talking about.
Well, and the house where much of the formative moments, many of the formative moments of the story is set, the Hidden Jade Path or the House of Lulu Mimi, is at the nexus of Shanghai and Western influences. Was that emblematic of courtesan culture, at least at the first class level?
What I found out is that they were very influential in bringing Western culture into Shanghai, making at least furniture, food and things like that acceptable. And I could only imagine that they would possibly help bridge the gap in other ways in business. The actual house that allowed Western men to come in as and be there as a, in a sort of social club, and Chinese men coming in for the first-class courtesan house atmosphere, that was made up. I made that up with bridging the two cultures, because usually Chinese people and Western people didn't do anything socially together. Business, yes. Social, no.
And you set this in what was known as the international settlement, which I don't know that many people are aware of. This was a part of Shanghai where Westerners lived essentially as Westerners among Westerners.
Yeah, it was like its own separate enclave, its own country. It operated by its own laws. its own police, the British police, American laws. And they were basically insulated throughout the beginning of the war until, for the U.S., December 7th, 1941, then they became part of Japanese territory. Otherwise, they were immune. And the courtesan houses were located in the international settlement. I didn't know it until recently that our family home was located there as well. So Chinese people lived there, but it was mostly set up for the foreigners.
And you mentioned your family home. If I'm not mistaken, the spark that set you on the road to writing this novel was a photograph you saw at a gallery that reminded you of one that you had seen many, many times.
I found it actually in a book after going to an Asian art museum exhibit on Shanghai. And I turned the page. I was looking. I thought it was so interesting. The women were so influential and powerful. And I turned the page and I saw 10 beauties of Shanghai, these 10 young women, five of them wearing an outfit identical to the outfit my grandmother is wearing in my favorite photo of her that I looked at every day as I wrote for inspiration.
And at the time you had – before then, you had no idea the significance of the outfit she wore.
I just thought it was a beautiful outfit. And this outfit was specific to courtesans. I read on. I thought, well, maybe it was a popular fashion. But it was a headband that came to a V at the top of the forehead, a tight jacket, collar went to below the – just below the earlobe, tight sleeves, lining showing, very specific, and the most – interesting, taken in a Western photo studio with pots of flowers around it. And I talked to three academics, and it was the Western photo studio that was the most significant.
And that's because typically there was no reason for a Chinese woman to be in a Western photo studio?
It just wasn't proper. The only women who went there were courtesans. The furniture was Western. They did poses that were not traditional. And the contrast to me, the effect of looking at this had a lot to do with the family stories about my grandmother, that she was old-fashioned, traditional, quiet. And the one thing I got out of this was she was not old-fashioned. Whether she was a courtesan, I would never be able to say for sure unless I saw a written document that she signed. It opened up a huge mystery of who this woman was. And that was the more important question, not what she did, but who she was. Not quiet, not traditional. And I found out through doing a lot more research, she had very strong opinions.
Was telling the story a way for you to fill in the gaps in your grandmother's real story, or did you simply take this element of ambiguity and then use it to craft something from whole cloth?
I did the latter, using the ambiguity, using the contradictions in the family stories, because I find that contradictions and ambiguity are the place where stories begin. I decided I would craft a completely different story. But what's similar is that these are women who found themselves thrown into a different situation. Suddenly their circumstances are changed, their lives upturned, and how would they have to remake themselves? What parts of them would always remain the same? What is their character? Who are they? That is the question I have of my grandmother. It is not her narrative. It is not about whether she really was a courtesan. So there are courtesans and they are different people.
Well, and certainly to put someone in the position of a woman in that era, in that place, needing to remake herself, there were not a lot of options.
No, you couldn't. What happened to a lot of these courtesans, some of them came from very well-to-do families, and the families lost all their wealth. What could they do? Lost the husband, had no support. Or they were kidnapped, girls who were kidnapped. Or, you know, their mothers had always been courtesans. But you couldn't just leave the courtesan house, go to school, and get a job as a teacher. You had to be born into a certain class, have a very modern family who decided to educate you. Or you were born into a servant class. I don't think people always understand that. You don't, in certain cultures and times, you didn't have a choice.
And certainly for Violet, who is the central character in most of the story, she is part American and part Chinese, which puts her in an even less advantageous position in Shanghai at this time.
Yeah. Mixed race girls, as they sometimes call them, or Eurasians, were looked down on both sides, you know, tainted in two ways. And a lot of them ended up in orphanages, never got adopted, never could marry, learned how to weave by the missionaries. So Violet was in a tenuous situation and somehow makes her way into the world, finding her place as a courtesan.
How much contemporary writing exists from that time about how these houses worked?
There is one particular book that I used. It was by a journalist in 1893 who visited courtesan houses every night. And he wrote fiction, but it was really based on his experiences. And that, to me, was the window into what really happened, the real life, the grievances, the competition, the jealousies, the men who were unfaithful and going off with other courtesans, the gifts that were required, that sort of thing. There were other books that had been written in the 1800s. So that's what I depended on, the fiction that was written.
There's a section of the book where you go into great detail about the hypothetical storytelling techniques a courtesan might use to seduce a patron, which is both hilarious and more than a little horrifying. And I'm curious whether it is entirely your imagination or whether it was inspired by some contemporary writing.
That was my imagination. But there is a story. It's a real story. Peach Blossom Spring.
Right.
Everybody knows that story. If you're Chinese and a kid, you grow up with it. And I just imagine the different ways you could tell that story, eroticize it a little. And that was probably a profane, you know, sacrilegious, tell this famous story as a seduction piece.
Although it is interesting, it leads one to start thinking about any number of Western fairy tales in the same way.
Yeah. I am sure Little Red Riding Hood could be turned into something like that.
On a more serious level, do you see a difference between the courtesan culture that existed at the turn of the last century in its time and place and the issues of sexual slavery and human trafficking that exist today?
Sex slavery is a huge problem. I'd say it's one of the top five, at least top 10 in the world. And in the United States, people think it's only in other countries. Sex slavery existed back then. Of course, little girls were kidnapped, or uncles or brothers would sell these girls. It was huge. So courtesans, actually, if they were kidnapped and became courtesans, they were quite lucky. They were courtesans who had freedoms after a while. They could get up when they wanted, design their own clothes, go out in public, ride in carriages, create themselves as seductresses and become businesswomen, negotiators. Whereas sex slaves, these little girls, 9 years old, they had to turn maybe 20 tricks a day. Horrible life, died young.
Was there inspiration for you for the painting from which this book takes its name?
I was in Berlin and doing a quick tour of the National Gallery. And I came across this painting called The Valley of Amazement. And it was so – it was that ambiguity we talked about where it was – it looked like a storm was coming or leaving. It looked like it was dawn or dusk. It was at once forbidding and maybe hopeful. And I was trying to decide, did the painter intend one or the other? Were we leaving or arriving? And I thought it was such a wonderful metaphor later that I wanted to use it as the title of the book because it captured what I found happens to all of us. We're at a crossroads. We have to see something. What are we really seeing? And we have to decide and go forward or leave. I saw another painting that was very much like that by Albert Bierstadt, who's an American painter, the Hudson River Valley School of Painting in the 1800s. And it was very similar, a storm, valley, dawn or dusk. That one looked more hopeful. You know, so he was an artist that I put in there. Unfortunately, I didn't note the name of the German artist. I'm sure the people in Germany, once it's translated, of course, it was Carl Blecken. How could you not know?
I'm curious. There is much that is unpleasant that plays out in the nearly 600 pages that make up the book. You know, there's rape and violence and betrayal. How do you, as a writer, when you're immersed in your work, how do you compartmentalize and be able to maintain this overall picture of yourself and where the book is going, and also channel the difficult stuff that's coming out of your pen or your fingers?
Well, for one thing, I do have a character who's a little bit more humorous, Magic Gordon, who's a sidekick who's very much like my mother in her voice. But all of those things that you talked about, the abandonment, rape, suicide, all of that was part of our family history. And I put it in there because it's meaningful to me. I also didn't want to glorify the sex trade. That would be very, very wrong. And here's the reality of what it is. Yes, they had a glamorous life, but here's what they're facing in the future. The life of the courtesan lasted very briefly from the age of, say, 14 or 15 until the early 20s. So I take these very bad situations, and I try to keep in mind with respect this was the life of women back then. And it's really to honor them for what they went through and for giving us, their descendants, a kind of strength that was passed on from one woman to her daughter to her granddaughter. And that's in me.
Amy Tan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Amy Tan's latest novel is called The Valley of Amazement. It was just included on the New York Times list of 100 notable books of 2013. She was in Milwaukee recently for an event at Alverno College and to visit her sister, who lives just west of town. That's Tuesday's edition of Lake Effect. Speaking of books, Lake Effect gardening contributor Melinda Myers has a bumper crop of new titles. We'll hear about them and much more on tomorrow's show. I'm Mitch Teich. It's so great to have you listening today, as it always is. Thanks so much for tuning in, and I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. We're NPR in Milwaukee. Keep listening. It's 11 o'clock, and fresh air comes your way next.